ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlossophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlossophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me... And of course, the voice you just heard was none other than Matthew Lillard. I mean, Chad Riley.
Ruby?
I'm here. I don't know why I'm so loopy, but I am.
That makes two of us. It's been, you know...
I know why I'm loopy. I've been staying up late watching episodes of The 100.
Is that what it is?
Like, eight different people over the course of 3 years told me to watch this show, and finally I relented and gave in, and I really like it.
Where does this show originate on? Because you've been talking about this for a little
bit. It's on the CW.
Is it?
Yeah, but I'm watching it on Netflix because I'm several years behind.
It is, so there's several seasons.
Oh yeah, there's three seasons on Netflix. I think the fourth one is what they're currently showing on the CW. Been around for a while.
Interesting. I might
just
have to get into it.
Catching up.
The Filmlossophers is presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded live each week at VGB Studios in Sacramento, California. New episodes debut every Wednesday morning on Libsyn, Audioboom, Google Play, iTunes, Player FM, and Stitcher. Don't limit your interactions to just listening, though. Engage with us on social media and keep the conversation going by liking the show on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlossophers and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlossophy101 for more opportunities to connect. Last but not least, you can access all of our previous episodes at vgbstudios.com alongside other amazing podcasts like Video Game Bang and Me, Myself, and I.
Eddie's working really hard on becoming a voiceover artist.
Now, did you ever used to call movie phone? That's what movie phone sounded like.
That's true, it did.
If you press number, or if you pick the movie, whatever, press one.
They also had that weird fast-forwarding sound. If you pick the movie,
truth. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, that's when they finally went out of business, I believe.
Well, because they were still recording everything on cassette tapes, obviously.
Truth.
Bad idea.
But, of course, this brings us to our conversation of the night.
This is a good idea.
So, we've been talking a lot about different movies in terms of this month and everything, and so, you know, we decided to kind of have a conversation. No, we're not playing the wrong music, nor are your ears deceiving you. We are playing Summertime, which is a summer song.
And it's not summertime yet.
No, it isn't. But it is gearing us right now and preparing our listeners for a summer conversation.
That's right, because summer in movies, summer comes earlier every year.
Truth. Today we're taking a revisit to the conversation that we had last year and digging a little deeper into the mystery known as summer blockbusters. So, last time we discussed the history of what it takes for a film to be a summer blockbuster and some of the distinguishing characteristics of those movies. You can actually catch that conversation in Lesson 24 over on vgbstudios.com to hear our thoughts there. But today we're going to discuss if the time frame of summer blockbusters are still technically released in the summertime and what that may or may not look like now. So...
In other words, it's possible that what we used to consider a summer blockbuster is really just now a blockbuster, and we don't need the summer part of it. Is that what we're saying?
Maybe, or maybe we're saying...
I don't know. I'm feeling a little iffy.
Yeah, I mean, there's...
I mean, obviously, studios still release big-budget movies in the summer because...
Oh, yeah.
Well, not everybody, but a lot of kids are out of school... Families take vacations, you know, people go to the movie theaters more often.
True. And the thing is that we're getting a lot more films that are dropping during the earlier months, right before summer. And, I mean, it's not like summer has, the season of itself has stayed the same for most people. I mean, if you look at the way schools go nowadays, they're releasing kids a lot earlier than before, or they release them It's all up in the air usually. So summertime.
Well, it used to be. I mean, I remember growing up. We're both millennials, and so maybe back in our day, you know, studios would actually wait to release their bigger budget films until at least Memorial Day. Memorial Day used to be kind of the start of the summer because some schools got out that early, others went into early June. Now you've got year-round school, like you mentioned. Mm-hmm. You've got all kinds of adjusted schedules. They start earlier, they end earlier, whatever. And studios are no longer feeling that they're 100% of the time confined to only late May and then June and July and maybe early August for their tentpole film properties. Their big budget, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of nine figures to make movies. And so it's been very interesting, especially in the last, 4 or 5 years, to see some really big films come out way ahead of Memorial Day. I mean, we just had The Fate of the Furious.
True.
That was, internationally, it was huge. It was enormous in April.
Yeah. So, to reiterate some of the key information from the last conversation we had, we mentioned that the term was made famous during the year of 1975 when it was used to describe the iconic film Jaws, released June 20th of that year. Since then, the term summer blockbuster has been used by media outlets, critics, fans, and just about every moviegoer to describe a big box office film released during the summer months. But is that still the case? True, a summer blockbuster is typically pushed to be released during the summertime or close to it, but like we were just saying, there has been a change in the air in terms of when a summer blockbuster is being released more recently. We were talking about...
AKA outside of the summer.
True, because like we said, you know...
Spoiler alert!
Most of the time, most of these films were typically between the months of June and July. You were saying Memorial Day, that's the last weekend of May. Which dovetails right into, you know, June and whatnot in terms of the following week for film releases. So, you know, normally I remember growing up, and like I said, I've mentioned this podcast several times, you know, what we used to do during the summers was we would go to movies, we would hit the theater, we would, you know, stay as long as we could and just enjoy movies all day long. It was during the summertime where this was more prevalent because of the fact that during the rest of the year, movies didn't really seem to interest me outside of, you know, during the summer months. When you went to the summer, when the summer came, you knew the big movies were coming out. You knew you wanted to see, you know,
And the movie theater had air conditioning, which was important to you in
Texas. Exactly, because in Texas, you were either sweating and burning alive outside or you were in an air-conditioned place. So, very true. But it's unique how before, summer blockbusters were pretty much defined in that time frame, and as we were saying, as the years had gone on, it seemed to like bleed over into late May, mid-May, early August, late August, all the way up into the beginning of May.
I'd say that though it's interesting, and I apologize, I'm getting ahead of ourselves, but I know that some of what we're going to talk about in terms of the makeup of a blockbuster, some of it has to do with I guess you could say the predictors of success, some of which are things like if it's a movie that's connected in some way to a franchise, whether it's a reboot or a continuation or a spinoff or whatever, if it's somehow connected to an established franchise that the Hollywood production, you know, executive group, they know that there's a fan base of some sort attached to it, then that is the type of movie that they would more likely consider for, you know, not going into the crowded summer schedule, but still trying to launch it at a time that it's going to make buku bucks. So you've got, like, for example, your superhero films. If Marvel and DC, and a smattering of, you know, others, but mainly Marvel and DC, through Disney and Warner Brothers, respectively, are going to be releasing 3 or even 4 movies each for the next foreseeable future, then, you know, that's 6 to 8 films you can't put all of them in this. You just can't.
Yeah.
They would dilute one another, even within their own set, within their own family. You know, four Marvel movies in a row during the summer, mm-hmm. or four DC films in a row during the summer, you'd dilute everything.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't get the return that you need from them. So they're going to look into November, February, April. You know, they're getting creative with where they plot them on the calendar.
True. And so let's just take a look at what we have been, what has typically been released as summer blockbusters in the past. You're looking at things like The Dark Knight, which was released in 2008. Star Wars Episode 1, which was released in 1999. These were all, mind you, during the months of June and July. Spider-Man 2002, Finding Nemo in 2003, Inside Out in 2015, Avengers in 2012, and of course, one of Chad's favorite films.
If I could do a convincing dinosaur roar, I would. But I can't. It would sound like Chewbacca with strep throat.
I think you might have to do that now. You're still going to have to do it.
I don't think I even could. I mean, the sound mixing team for this film was so phenomenal. I don't know that any human pharynx, thank you very much, vocabulary, and vocal cords could mimic the noise of the Tyrannosaurus Rex in Jurassic Park. But that's what you're getting at, is Jurassic Park.
Jurassic Park, yes, 1993's. So these films...
I remember it well.
That he does.
I was a young lad. I was 10, actually. I was a decade old.
You were a decade old.
I was a decade old.
Wow.
Yep.
There you go. Well, these...
Sorry, fun fact. Now moving on.
The films vary widely in terms of the types of movies they are, but they all have a few things in common. One of those things is there was high anticipation for each of them. So that begs to ask the question then, does the anticipation from other films constitute them as summer blockbusters? What do you think, Chad?
Okay. does the anticipation of other films contribute to the anticipation of a blockbuster film? Or does just the anticipation of the summer blockbuster film make it a blockbuster?
Do you think that could be make it a blockbuster?
I don't think anticipation alone can. I mean... It can make a movie successful, right? So mm-hmm. I think that in terms of if you have a film, and I'm thinking of things kind of off the beaten path, like the Blair Witch Project.
Okay.
You know, back in the day. The style of that film was very unique. And so there was a bit of a curiosity factor. That went into influencing people to go see it. I mean, yeah, people like scary movies and they want to go, you know, be scared in new ways that they never knew they could be scared before.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the found footage format of the Blair Witch Project, the insinuation that it was actual found footage and not a fictional movie, mm-hmm. right? That it was actual home video of these teenagers in the forest or wherever they were. And so I think sometimes you do have that kind of novelty effect that builds anticipation and can make a movie successful. But I don't know, a successful film and a blockbuster film, I think those are still two different levels.
Hmm.
And don't get me wrong, Blair Witch Project like way earned back its operating budget.
No joke.
Like way above and beyond. So within its category, sure, I mean, you could probably call it a blockbuster, but mm-hmm. it didn't go, I mean, movies nowadays, they go upwards of $1 billion in ticket sales worldwide. And it was nowhere near that. So to have a movie that's truly a blockbuster that literally like everybody that you know, well, 80% of the people that you know go and see it when it's in the theater. They don't wait for it to be on Redbox or on Netflix or on Amazon or whatever, or to buy it, you know, which who knows how many people actually buy movies anymore. But, you know, they don't wait for it. Like we've seen overall in the movie theater business, ticket sales kind of decline. I mean, not kind of, they decline. The number of booties sitting in the chairs goes down over time.
Ooh, because Jeds and booties.
So, anyway, there are fewer people going. And just overall, over the course of the entire year, domestically at least, I guess I can't say globally necessarily, because there are some markets globally that actually are growing. And that's a growing influence on the entire movie-making process, which is going to be really exciting to see how that influences the funding and the storylines and just everything about movies in the next 10 to 20 years. That global influence, I think, is going to have a big, big role to play in Hollywood. But all that being said, a blockbuster makes a boatload and a half of money. And so even successful films, I don't know that anticipation alone is enough. I think that you need anticipation. I think you also kind of need a high price tag. I think that the
high
more
production value on
High production value and the entertainment press talking about how much money it took to make this movie. Because I think that in and of itself is in a way a litmus test of how much faith the studio has in the project. And therefore people are willing to maybe put aside reservations and say, okay, well, you know, like for example, Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. I like sci-fi. I like The Fifth Element, which Luc Besson is the same. It directed The Fifth Element. It was weird, off the beaten path, whatever, and I liked it. Here, Valerian, I'm like, eh. My gut says I would easily pass on that movie. However, it's based on an established property that's been very famous overseas for many years. They put a boatload of money into it, and that might be enough to convince me to go give it a shot. And, you know, spend some money that adds to their ticket receipt haul.
Yeah, and you know, for me, you kind of hit it on the head when it came to Blair Witch. I don't know. I think I might have to disagree. I think anticipation does lend to what becomes a summer blockbuster, because you look at films like, going back to talking about Jaws, that film was built up so much that everybody anticipated it. And I think because of the anticipation, if it's not overhyped, but it's still well within the means of what the film's going to deliver, then I think it could constitute as a summer blockbuster in my mind.
Well, and I think that, I mean, Jaws is a dated reference at this point because it was it went first, right? So, I mean, that's what, 40 something years ago, like 42 years ago, you know? So I think the definition of blockbuster honestly has changed, you know, since it was kind of founded. I mean, because you have movies that make back their budget and then some and are very successful, but they don't always anymore get classified as a blockbuster film. I think that there are definitely some maybe within the industry, and I think really in the movie going public, but some expectations of what qualifies as a blockbuster film. And we talked about that in the previous episode.
Yeah.
And we've got a few notes here that we'll probably hit on as well. But I don't know. I don't think that anticipation on its own is enough anymore to make it a blockbuster.
I think those are the
outliers.
I see what you mean. I see what you mean. So you're saying that at one point it was what was necessary to make a summer blockbuster, but as things evolved...
I don't think you could have a blockbuster without anticipation.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. I definitely agree with that.
I got you.
You can't just like, surprise, we dropped a movie yesterday and then the whole world goes and sees it. You know, like, that doesn't work. You'll have like five people go see it.
True. Well, another unique commonality that actually we mentioned a little bit ago between all these films was that each of these films was a part of a franchise. You look at, obviously, like The Dark Knight. The Dark Knight was a part of a franchise. Star Wars Episode One, obviously. Spider-Man, Finding Nemo, which you didn't find out until later that there was a sequel.
Well, in a way, though, I mean, Pixar, the quality of Pixar films, it's almost like they're a genre of their own, or a franchise of their own,
or much
where,
like,
you know, the movies might be interconnected. I mean, there are a lot of fan theories about how they all connect, but, or they might not be, but still they're connected by the thread of Pixar.
True. No. And actually, you make a great point because of the fact that the universe theory that every Pixar film belongs in the same universe,
right?
Just at different time frames of, you know, the life of that universe. So that makes a little bit more sense, you know, in terms of franchise. You can look at it that way.
In a way. I mean, I still think, I mean, we've talked about this off air several times. I still think quite a lot of that pontificating is a bit of a stretch, to say the least.
I don't know. We might have to do a whole episode just on film
theories.
Then
I'd have to, like, pay attention to all that.
Truth, because it's... I don't know. It's, so
I just don't know.
That whole Pixar theory... I don't know. It seems to be gaining some ground. Yeah, mind you, there are a few pieces of that puzzle.
There are a few that are a bit of a mental leap.
Yeah, that takes a little bit of a stretch. Like the whole utilizing Good Dinosaur as part of the whole means as to why that universe is the way it is. And
right.
Some of that is a stretch. But
well, it's interesting. I mean, kind of like Jaws, the progenitor of the summer blockbuster term.
Mm-hmm.
That means the first. The one that started it. Sorry,
I guess I'm
in
power.
Like a vocabulary mode today. I don't know what's up with me, but
we'll have a word of the episode by the end of this.
Similar to that, you know, you've got Finding Nemo and Inside Out on this list.
Mm-hmm.
Similar to Jaws, they're the only ones on this short list that aren't a part of a franchise unless you go with the Pixar theory and call Pixar the franchise.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, Finding Nemo became the first of a duology after a decade, right? Because even Jurassic Park, which kicked off a franchise, was based on a book that had already been fairly popular when the movie was made. Now, the movie, like, exploded its popularity as a property, but many Michael Crichton fans already were familiar with the story of the book and anticipating, therefore, the movie. Similar with Spider-Man. Spider-Man had not been done in a Hollywood film of this caliber until that first Spider-Man, the Sam Raimi Spider-Man 2002, but the character had a 60-year publishing history with Marvel Comics, multiple cartoon shows, other movie attempts along the way, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it may have been the first of that franchise set of films, but it was already an established property. Finding Nemo and Inside Out, aside from being founded on the Pixar Brain Trust, they didn't have any anchor points, but they did very, very well and deserved to do very, very well. So it's interesting. I think overall, you do need some kind of anchor for a movie in order to launch it into that kind of a stratosphere level. You do have your surprise, like, darlings that just explode, and it's great. But, you know, if you look at blockbuster movies over the last, 42 years, you'd probably find that most of them are connected. Before the movie comes out, they're already connected to some kind of an established motif or storyline.
Well, seeing as these particular ones are part of a or some type of franchise, so going back to the whole idea, so what does that mean for other anticipated franchises, especially those released close to the summer months? And
you're not making this about Ghost in the Shell again, are you?
Oh God, no! Please, no! No, this is kind of the main point that we want to come across is these types of films. The ones that are released close to summer months, such as May, April, even pushing as far as March to see what looks to be the new possible starting point for what could be our new summer time frame, our summer blockbuster time frame. Because like we mentioned, summer ultimately now is based now on when the schools let out and when people have that opportunity to have a summer break. I mean, we work, we don't have summer break, but, you know, kids and whatnot.
Truth.
So it's one of those things where...
Children, you've been warned. Adulting does not give you summer breaks unless you're a teacher.
Unless you're a teacher.
Or like a doctor, or, you know, like somebody buku bucks.
I don't know.
And then you just like take off for
After
months.
Watching some of these TV shows about doctors, I at one point thought, I would love to be a doctor. And then after seeing some of these shows, I'm like, I don't want to be a doctor.
You're cured.
Yeah, no joke. I'm like, I'm
You're
okay.
Cured.
So looking at the numbers, if we take a look, so for the month of May, so I went back and I looked through all of our all of the box office numbers for the months during the course of the year. And for the month of May, out of the top 12 highest grossing films during the month of May, 11 were part of a franchise at the time, each grossing over $300 million. So this is going back to May. Let's see. Let me take a look. So we got the one of the top grossing films in the month of May was...
And is that $300 million in the overall domestic box office during their run, or $300 million in opening weekend counting all global receipts? Do you know?
I think it's counting all global.
It's not too shabby for a one weekend haul of $300 million.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I know the Fate of the Furious got 500 and however many. But I mean, that was beyond what the estimators even thought
it
could do. So
looking at some of these films though, I mean, I actually have them here. You know, things like The Avengers, Avengers Age of Ultron, Shrek 2. I would consider that one, I almost consider that one non-franchise, but then it is a sequel. So, and there's like 1,200 Shrek movies out there now, including a Broadway musical. Like I said, The Phantom Menace, Iron Man 3, Captain America 3, Spider-Man, Revenge of the Sith. We had mentioned Finding Nemo, Spider-Man 3,
Oy.
Iron Man, and Iron Man 2. So looking at all these films, I mean...
And these are just month of May.
This is just the month of May.
Films that released in the month of May.
But, I mean, looking at these films, it seems like there's kind of a bit of a trend, if you ask me, in terms of what we're seeing in those months. And obviously the trend is...
Marvel.
Marvel films. Comic book films. That's what it really comes down to.
Makes me very proud.
Comic book films. You're looking at a really large uproar of what we see as comic book films. Ever since the debut of...
Yeah, 8 out of 10.
Yeah. Ever since the debut of Iron Man in 2008, it just seems
Excuse
to be...
Excuse me, 8 out of 12, sorry. 8 out of 12. Sometimes I can't count right. 8 out of 12.
Hey, I was going to trust you, don't worry. But if you look at... I mean, ever since the beginning of Iron Man 2008, you know, you look at that, and it seems like May has been a key month for the Marvel rollout. It's interesting to look at this and to say, okay, well, you know, May seems to be a good month to begin looking at, you know, hey, what's coming out?
Which totally makes sense. It's just basically saying instead of starting the clock at Memorial Day at the end of May, mm-hmm. we would just start the clock earlier in May.
True. Very true.
Certainly hasn't hurt Disney, Marvel.
Oh, no, not at all. But there is a but. And it's a big but.
He said but.
I said but. But if we go back one more month and we look at April. April, however, only had 5 films that grossed over $200 million, with obviously Fate of the Furious well on its way to break that mark. We haven't yet...
Oh, it already broke that mark.
Oh, that's right.
$200 million and it made like 547 or something globally in its first weekend.
Yeah.
And it had a good second one this past weekend as well. So
they with
did good. They done good.
So does that mean, though, with only 5, maybe 6 of these films breaking that much, does that mean that April doesn't count? Nope. Because it means that with what we have here, with the information that we have available to us, we can equate that the highest grossing films in April, correlating with the use of the data, it means that we can actually go to the exact year when summer blockbusters began to shift. And by shift, I am using that as a pun because it all started with a Fast and the Furious movie. So if we go back to 2011 is when Fast 5 began the streak of pulling back the curtain of summer blockbusters early enough to the month of April and giving fans the cure to their racing itch sooner than they imagined. So it seems...
His name is The Rock.
It's true.
Honestly, Five was where they plugged The Rock into the franchise.
No, you're very true. That's very true. And you know
Let
what?
Let that be a lesson to you, Universal. You need to hire that man again and put him in the spinoff movie with Jason Statham. That's
mm-hmm.
all.
And pretty much just about every film after the fact, I think minus six. Yeah, looking at, I don't see six in this list for April, but I mean, you got Fast Five, Furious Seven, and then Eight, which
obviously,
is this recent
one. Fate of the Furious.
You know, these all having Mr. Dwayne The Rock Johnson, and them all being a franchise film, I think that kind of constitutes it as a possible summer film. What do you think?
I mean, I think it's at a certain level, there's nothing earth-shattering about saying, hey, Hollywood, you're more likely to have wild success with an established property than with something that nobody knows. I mean, like, that's kind of just like, okay, well, that's not news to anybody. Even if you do have millions upon millions of people around the nation and around the world who regularly complain about no new ideas coming from Hollywood. You know, and I'm on that train sometimes, you know, where I'm saying, where are all the fresh ideas? You know, and yet, when your goal is to have a blockbuster film that makes nine figures upon nine figures upon nine figures very quickly.
Yeah.
You have, I don't, what, like an 8-2 chance of doing that with an established property than a not established property.
Yeah.
I mean, it's extremely rare for something to come in out of nowhere and make that amount of cash. Doesn't mean that it's impossible. It's just, it's very rare. And therefore, should be celebrated, Pixar, when it happens again and again, Pixar.
It's true. No, it's that's dead on the money.
Sorry, now I'm stepping off of my soapbox.
No, it's very
my
true.
My computer-generated soapbox.
And I think, you know, with the trend that we're getting and with the likeliness of hearing that Dwayne The Rock Johnson and Jason Statham are in talks with Universal Studios to actually create their spinoff. And if they keep with their pattern of releasing in the month of April, I think that's just going to solidify what we're trying to say here, which is that, yeah, I mean, it's just as good of a month as any. And doing that, it's a unique aspect of movie releasing. Because if you look at April hasn't exactly had the most luxurious month just in this month alone. You know, you take a look at this month, and this one was kind of on the boring end of...
Sure, I mean, you still don't have... the studios are still stacking the movies that they need to be that successful. They still stack them in May, June, July. There's no question about that, because they know that the audience is more available and more apt to spend some of their money going to the movie theater multiple times. They'll put movies like Fate of the Furious in April, because they've been successful in April before, so why not? But most of the films that are releasing anywhere from January through April, they don't need that kind of a cash influx. They, in order to make back their budget and be successful, they don't need to be the $300 or $500 million behemoth in their opening weekend. They need to make $20 million or more, and they're good, you know. Yeah. And then everything from there is icing on the cake.
True,
and it's worth not forcing. I think from a philosophical standpoint, it's worth having movies that don't have $100 million budgets. Like, it's worth having those stories. A blockbuster, a movie that's kind of out of the box, meant to be a blockbuster, that has the huge production value, huge price tag, big name actors and all that. A movie like that versus some of your film festival darlings that are getting new names and new faces on the map for the first time, and that's where some of your new story content is really coming from. There are benefits to both. You know, you have extremely well done, very entertaining stuff from the blockbuster set, and you've got, you know, sometimes deep, emotional, philosophical, theological, like whatever you want to call it, stuff going on in these indie films and smaller budget movies. And I think that you definitely, we wouldn't want them, we wouldn't want studios, we would easily become dissatisfied with movie-going culture if the whole calendar all year long was stuffed with blockbusters. You know, number one, Hollywood wouldn't make all their money back. Mm. And number two, we would get blockbuster fatigue. Right now, at least, blockbuster fatigue is quarantined to some extent to the summertime.
Yeah.
You know, and it's those times when people are like, well, I got nothing else to do. I'll go see Pirates of the Caribbean 5. I'll go see Transformers The Last Knight. Okay, fine. Well, you can do that. I mean, we'll probably be there. I'm not disparaging it. I mean, it is a film podcast. We will see those movies, but we don't have to like it.
And that's not to say they may not surprise us. I mean, who knows? This next Transformers movie might be the Transformers film that needed to happen at the very beginning.
Have Sir Anthony Hopkins.
Exactly.
I don't know why he would agree to do the movie, but he did. So
help me, Lord Jesus. I really hope that Sir Anthony Hopkins doesn't turn into the next Ben Kingsley.
I know, yeah, just the whole...
Because, I mean, look at the last two movies.
Let's plug him in to add gravitas to the movie, and then actually it does the opposite.
Because you remember, well, you probably don't, because I don't think anybody went to go see it, the film that he came out with last year, where he plays a psychic who helps the police go after another psychic, I guess, Colin Farrell.
Oh, right, that was earlier this year, actually.
Oh, was
Solace?
It? Solace, yeah.
I think that was in early February or something.
See?
Yeah.
That's how bad it was.
It's already in Redbox if you want to watch it. I've seen it. I mean, I haven't seen the film, but I've seen it in the Redbox.
But it's just... Side tangent, of course. It's just one of those things where I really hope he's not at a place where he's like, oh, yeah, I'll do that. Oh,
it's
yeah.
a paycheck.
Yeah, but no. No.
But see, here's the thing, though. Samuel L. Jackson. The man makes like 30 movies a year on average or something.
And they're funny.
And some of them are blockbusters and some of them are not. Like some of them are really terrible. They're meant to be terrible, but he has a lot of fun and he stays busy. And that's part of his whole thing. Like that's part of what he loves about being a performer.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't all have to be stellar. It's just with a name like Anthony Hopkins, you're hoping that it would be.
Yeah.
But then you also have a name like Transformers, and you know what the track record has looked like after the first one.
Yeah. So with all the information that we just talked about, what does this mean for the future of summer blockbusters? Does it mean that, and we're talking realistically, obviously we can, you know, pontificate and assume that what's best for Hollywood is what we're saying and that Hollywood should follow it. We can do that till the cows come home. But in all reality, what is all this information that we've seen, that we've talked about thus far, what does that translate to for the possibility of the future of summer blockbusters? How likely is it that we will start seeing promotions of summer blockbusters as early as April?
I think it's a bigger question, though. I think that the trends that we're seeing that the industry is starting to really respond to is when we say, so you and I mm-hmm. and your lovely wife, we took a trip last July down under to Australia, right? And we went during the 4th of July. Mm-hmm. So we weren't home for the 4th of July. We were overseas, and it was interesting because Australia is in the southern hemisphere, which means the seasons are flipped. So mm-hmm. it was the middle of winter for them.
Mm-hmm.
Thankfully, in Sydney, that really meant it was sort of like the Bay Area. I mean, there wasn't like blizzard conditions or anything like that. But all that to say, to look at the map and say, well, are summer blockbusters going to go away? I think that we need to stop calling them summer blockbusters and just saying blockbuster films because. Mm. Whose summer are we talking about? That's a very, at best, northern hemisphere-centric way of looking at it. And that's not the way that the receipts are really telling. If you look at The Fate of the Furious, so I have looked up from Variety. So near the tail end of its first weekend, Variety was projecting $534 million in ticket sales. And I don't know what the final number was because I didn't care to look up a different article because it had this really cool stat that I wanted to say. So of that $534 million opening weekend, $103.8 was the estimated United States gross. The foreign box offices combined were $430.4 million. And I think that that is the trend. You know, we were mentioning earlier, it's going to be interesting to see in the next 10 to 20 years, in a way, like, how does Hollywood stay competitive on a global scale now instead of just domestic? And that is going to be things like release big movies in the middle of North American winter because you have other markets that, or release big movies whenever, I mean, I don't really know the Chinese education system, but like, do they have a break? Like a multi-week or a multi-month break from school? Or do they go year-round? I honestly just don't know. I'm ignorant. I'll be the first one to admit that. But, you know, would you have some better success if you know that it's a property that's going to do very well in Chinese markets? Like, then you actually schedule its release based on something other than the American movie going public. I think those are the trends that are more interesting. You know, the I don't know, the number geek inside of me, which he's much less than the word nerd or the film buff or whatever. But like, the numbers geek inside of me is really genuinely interested in knowing how is this ratio going to impact Hollywood and release schedules and filming locations and the names of the performers and the directors and I mean, already a lot of the effects studios are overseas. I mean, you still have your ILM, you still have some mainstays, but I mean, a lot of them, if you actually look at the names that are scrolling during the credit sequences of the big movies nowadays, it's tremendous. And you know, I think it's quite beautiful in the way that that the Olympics appeal to me. The Olympics appeal to me because it's like a snapshot of the whole world. Like, the whole world, presumably, is coming together.
Yeah.
You know, for a common goal. And a lot of times with these larger movies where you've got multiple effects houses, multiple shooting locations, multiple camera crews, you know, all these A unit, B unit, all this stuff happening behind the scenes. When you look at the names as they scroll, the diversity and variety of names is incredible and very cool to see. And I think we're going to see more of that as the years go by. Because if the Chinese market is responding better to something like Fate of the Furious than the American market, then it's time to get some prominent Chinese characters into the movies. You know, and I mean, it's just, it's, there's an opportunity for, you know, a beautiful synthesis of cultures and viewpoints that, you know, Hollywood has a unique opportunity to be kind of at the forefront of that should they so choose.
Yeah. And I agree with your point in terms of reshaping the whole term of going from summer blockbusters to just blockbusters, because that's what it was. The term blockbusters was associated with the season of summer because of Jaws, and so summer blockbuster became the coin of phrase. And so as time went on, you know, but I think you bring up a really good point that is where the mindset needs to evolve to, where we now look at films that debut April, May, even March, and still consider the fact that they could be a blockbuster, but the summer tagging, I guess, if you want to call it, should be removed.
Well, and we've got to get comfortable with movies being a blockbuster elsewhere, and maybe they don't succeed very well in the American market. You know, I mean, Transformers, I know we harp on it regularly, and I think that it's deserved in many respects.
Very much
but
so.
Those movies do fantastically overseas. There's, from a budget standpoint, from just numbers on the spreadsheet standpoint, there is no reason to stop making those movies because they rake in the cash. They might not rake in the cash from Americans, although they oftentimes still do get a nice influx here domestically. But even if most of their cash flow is coming from the other markets, it's a lot of cash.
Yeah, it is.
So from an economic perspective, it's worth it to keep, you know, keep having movies like that on the docket, even if they don't succeed necessarily in the American market. You know, the American market in terms of movie going, in some respects, it's not always, you know, the front runner anymore of you know, what, how do you indicate success?
True. So looking at what we have to look forward to in terms of this year.
This is my favorite part.
What are some of the upcoming blockbusters to be that you're most excited about?
Well, I mean, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2
yep.
is like essentially moments away, right? And
true.
It has given me every reason to just like basically jitter with this combination of like caffeine and giddiness, right? Because the first one was so refreshing, and this one, even if it's not, it's not going to have the novelty effect that the first one had because we're already familiar with most of the characters. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So I'm really looking forward to Guardians. I know we're planning to maybe do like a little 1-2 punch.
Truth.
Where we give a little review of the first Guardians because that came out before we had this podcast, and then followed up with a review of the new one. So that'll be fun and exciting. I'm also really looking forward in May. I'm looking forward to King Arthur, Legend of the Sword. I love Arthurian mythology, and I'm a big fan of Guy Ritchie. So put those two together. I don't care if it's like accurate. I think it's going to be a spectacle, and I'm going to enjoy it. How about you, Eddie?
You know what? Looking at the list, I have to be honest. There's quite a few, but I don't think any of them really speak to me more than films like Alien Covenant, which comes out in May 19th. I am so stoked in terms of this film because of what it's supposed to bring to the table and what it's supposed to follow up from in terms of Prometheus. I love sci-fi, and so this is one that's definitely on my radar. Of course, I'm going to agree totally with you on Guardians of the Galaxy. That looks like a great film from what I'm hearing from critics. It even sounds like it's going to be a great film. Mm-hmm. So that's a win-win either way. I'm not even worried about that. That one I know is going to knock it out of the park. But like Alien Covenant, Cars 3, maybe. I was at one point kind of anxious for it, but so much time has gone by since I've heard anything about it that I'm losing interest.
I was going to say, it's kind of fallen off the radar a little bit. I mean, they have until the beginning of or the middle of June, but you would have thought they would have done another trailer by this point.
Oh, easily.
I would have thought that.
No. And I would have thought that too, because I'm thinking, I'm like, okay, well, this is, you know, it's, you know, sooner or later. But nothing. I haven't heard anything. So I've ultimately almost 80-85% lost interest. Spider-Man Homecoming is obviously one of those ones. I want to see where Sony's going to go. So it's like having your big brother show you how to make this incredible card structure with, you know, playing cards, like a card house, and like, okay, your turn. So Sony's now got the ball, and they're like, okay, I can do it too. And they're trying to, so I want to see if they can build that same house.
Right. I mean, Marvel basically said, okay, we gave you a Spider-Man that's really, really good. Now don't break him.
Yes, exactly.
Also, we're loaning you Iron Man, who built our entire multi-billion-dollar franchise.
It would totally be like a finger in the eye of Sony, is if in this film, for some reason, they decide to try to kill off Tony Stark.
Okay, that would be the worst decision on record. And we have like we have dancing Tobey Maguire, stupid Peter Parker, Spider-Man.
And this is beyond
in
that pool.
And this that would be like magnitudes worse. Yeah, that's not happening.
And then aside from all of those, I'm really, really, really excited for the Dark Tower. Having Idris Elba play the gunslinger, Matthew McConaughey play the Man in Black. The story is so mesmerizing, and it's so in depth. I'm currently reading it right now while also reading other books, but from what I've gathered thus far, it seems like a really intense story, and I can't wait to see it translated with, of course, Idris Elba. I mean, you can't pick a finer actor than Idris Elba to play the gunslinger, and I don't know, anything so far with Idris Elba has scored high marks with me. I don't think there's yet to be a situation where Idris Elba was on screen and I didn't want him to be.
True.
So
I'd say that's very accurate. And The Dark Tower, for those of you who don't know, is an adaptation of a book series by Stephen King. Usually he does one-off kind of standalone novels, and The Dark Tower is a whole cycle. Yeah, how many books are in the series? Do you know?
I think there's 7 books, not to mention the graphic novels.
Right.
Not to mention the in-between books and the offshoots. They made in-between.
So it's a big, on paper, it's a big franchise.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see how that translates into film and whether the audience arrives in the theater or not. I think that they definitely have the star power that they need. I know they had a lot of trouble getting it off the ground. Ron Howard was trying to get it off the ground for several years, and it just wasn't taking off for whatever reason. So now they finally have some different things going on behind the scenes. They've got their 2 main stars, so let's hope it does well. I'm also really looking forward to Wonder Woman. We've said before, and I specifically, as much as I'm a huge fan, I grew up reading Marvel Comics. To a lesser extent, DC Comics. You know, I read Batman. Mm-hmm. I read some Superman. I didn't read much of the other ones. I was much more invested in the Marvel comic book universe and have given a lot of money to the Marvel Cinematic Universe over the years. And I'm not ashamed of any of it. But and also given money and tried to hope in the DC Cinematic Universe.
Yeah.
And I think Wonder Woman, I mean, I don't want to say it's make or break for them, but I really want Wonder Woman to succeed. I think that they have a chance of finally having some solid ground and some solid footing under them for the rest of their multi-picture, you know, mega franchise cinematic universe, if they can get that movie really right.
That's so true, because right now,
and that's June 2nd, by the way, for those of you keeping score with release dates.
Yes. And I think it needs to be said that right now Wonder Woman stands to be the only viable asset that DC and Warner Brothers has in terms of a DCEU. So if this doesn't hit that, you know, hit that bar that a lot of fans are hoping it'll hit, I don't know if this franchise can keep moving forward. That's not to say that it won't make it, and that's not to say that it will. All I'm saying is I'm pulling for it. I'd love for it to be an incredible film, just like I wish Justice League was a great film and Suicide Squad was a great film.
I think that from a dollar's perspective, it's definitely going to make it. I think there's enough anticipation, to go back to an earlier point, there's enough anticipation about this character and this version of this character in specific that it's going to make the box office sales. I don't think that's a question. It's more a question of the reception of the film. Does it hit the right notes? Because there's been a lot of hope in the other DCEU properties, and the response to those films has not been as favorable as Warner Brothers would like it to be. And so, you know, I think it's more a question of the reception of the film, not so much the ticket sales. I think that Wonder Woman, people have wanted a Wonder Woman movie for a long time. Mm-hmm. And they've been trying for a long time, like 25 years behind the scenes. And now they finally have one. So hopefully it does well.
So let us know what you're looking forward to this summer. What blockbusters are you hoping to catch in theaters? And which ones do you think are going to pass? Which ones do you think are going to fail? Drop us a comment in our Facebook page and let us know your thoughts, because we'd love to hear them. Before we go, we're going to leave you with a little bit of movie news. And the top of our list is something that I'm excited about.
You've been excited about this ever since, well, before we started talking on
Truth. The Jeff Goldblum joins the cast for Jurassic World 2.
You just can't get rid of him.
The man, the myth, the legend. Jeff Goldblum, who co-starred in 1993's Jurassic Park and the 1997's The Lost World Jurassic Park, will appear in Universal Pictures and Amblin Entertainment's next Jurassic World film. The story first broke as an exclusive on the Hollywood Reporter website and has made its way to our brains and thus to your ears. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Ian Malcolm has come back to the franchise. I am excited for that. That
is, and everybody does a little drop of water on the back of their hand.
Oh yeah,
in honor of his return.
The butterfly. The
you know, honestly, we mentioned it earlier. Mm-hmm. I love Jurassic Park. That was my jam as a 10-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
It scared the tar out of me in a couple of spots in the movie theater, but I loved it. And I thought that I don't think that Jurassic Park could have worked with Dr. Ian Malcolm alone, but the way that Jeff Goldblum played that character in Jurassic Park was one of the absolute highlights of the film. It mm-hmm. could not have worked without him.
I agree.
Well, it could not have worked to the extent that it worked without him.
I agree. And he's, you know what? It's just, it's the quirkiness in him. It's the unique aspect that he always, it's not even the fact that he plays the role well. He's just weird. And I like that
he's
about
watchable.
Him. He's watchable. I mean, you see him all the way from when he did stuff like from The Fly all the way to his recent stuff. I mean, he's playing whomever he's playing in the new Thor Ragnarok movie.
Oh, right, the Games Master.
And so it's incredible seeing how he can just be put into a role and his weirdness just matches. It just fits the bill.
Well, and the interesting thing, I don't know, have you ever read the book Jurassic Park?
Yes.
So in the book, Dr. Malcolm is one of the prominent characters in the book, and specifically, they have different section breaks in between phases of the story, and there are little kind of almost like little quotables at the start of each part, and they're Dr. Malcolm's iterations, because he's talking about chaos theory and, you know, all this stuff, just like the character in the movie does. And so, you know, he's got this kind of not unapproachable but highly intellectual quality in the book, where you're like, you're thinking on a whole different level than anybody in the story or any of us who are reading the story. Like, you're just, you're foreshadowing things because your brain somehow puts two and two together. And I think Jeff Goldblum really, I mean, the way that he plays any character, it's not necessarily that he's the smartest man in the room, but he just thinks on a totally different wavelength from all the other characters or the audience that it makes it completely watchable.
It's so great. And he brings that type of character. I think that aspect of the character out really well. Now that, because it's been a while since I've read it, but now that you mention it, he does bring a lot of that to the forefront of this character.
Yeah, I mean, I think the character was quite a bit more dry in the book. You know, I mean, he was the intellectual and kind of in a way the doomsday naysayer in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of the perspective that he had, because of the way that his brain worked. And then take all of that, which is still part of the character on paper, and then add Jeff Goldblum's like tics and tricks and mannerisms. And there you go.
I'm so excited. So we'll be on the lookout for what else is to come out with that film and all the Jeff Goldblum goodness. But lastly on our movie news list, we got Disney Studios and 20th Century Fox release full schedules of upcoming movie release dates. So we got some goodies this week. Walt Disney Studios and 20th Century Fox have done what every great studio should do and let people in.
Talk about building hype.
In very much the Disney fashion, and kind of actually the opposite of the Fox fashion. Both of these studios have released a full schedule of what big films they plan to release in the coming years. That's right. I didn't say months. I said years. We got a good size list to sift through. I'm tripping myself up, but I can tell you this.
You're so excited.
I can tell you this. I'm super stoked with what I see here. Just going off of Disney's list, I mean, you're looking...
Eddie's really excited about Frozen 2.
Oh, you have no idea.
2019, he cannot wait.
Hashtag bring back Olaf. Yeah, from 20...
Well, he didn't go anywhere.
Well, there was talks that he wasn't going to come back in the sequel.
Really?
Yeah.
That would have been dumb on their part.
That would have been really dumb. But, I mean, Disney, Walt Disney Studios has brought us like 2017, 2018, 2019, 2020, and 2021 release dates. So, I mean, just looking at this list, I mean, you got Mulan for next year. You got the Mary Poppins Returns next December. You got Toy Story 4. I don't know where they're going to go with that. And then a ton of untitled Marvel films.
Yeah, well, and they control the Star Wars franchise, which has a ton of movies in those years as well.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the 20s...
And they've already said they have plans for Star Wars through, like, what, 2025 or something? Or 2027? Yeah. I mean, just until you can't even see that far ahead.
That's true. And then even with 20th Century Fox, it isn't that large of a list, I don't believe.
But they're big ones.
They are big ones. I mean, you're looking at... Do you want to go ahead and go through? Because I know that's...
New Mutants,
uh-huh.
Which is an X-Men-related property, for those of you who don't know.
April 13, 2018.
You've got Deadpool 2.
June 1st, 2018.
Which is going to include Cable, which we talked about last episode. Josh Brolin has been cast as
Pierce
Cable.
Pierce Brosnan was cast. Gotcha.
Nope, he was not.
John Hamm
Josh,
was casted.
Nope. Thanos. and X-Men Dark Phoenix.
Mm-hmm. November 2nd, 2018.
So
now here's a quick question.
In 1 year.
And then of course we got four Avatar sequels lined
up. Yeah, they've got
till 2020.
If they can ever get made, James Cameron, we're
seriously
looking at you.
How out of the three X-Men films that we have listed, what are you most excited for?
That's a good question. I don't know how to answer that. I would say the one that I'm most familiar with would be Dark Phoenix. The one that I'm most excited about, though, might actually be New Mutants.
Really?
Because I think that really the way that the New Mutants worked in the comics was the parent franchise, if you will, the X-Men franchise, had gotten back into a state of health because it was almost canceled several times. It was canceled, I think, for a while, and then brought back with Giant Size X-Men number one, which is where you have Wolverine and Storm, Nightcrawler, Colossus, Banshee, all those. And then they had, you know, some success 70s into the 80s, and then they launched this new franchise, the New Mutants, which was kind of, okay, all the X-Men had grown up, they were world adventurers and superheroes, but what happened to the, like, kids in school aspect of the story? And that's what the New Mutants kind of brought back, that sort of a focus to the franchise. I think that the movie could do very similar things here, where the parent property, X-Men, has grown up a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Deadpool is very grown up in terms of its audience and the R rating and all the, you know, the wordplay and violence and everything. I think New Mutants could definitely be a way of modernizing the movie version and getting back to the roots of young people finding out their mutants and learning to deal with their powers and abilities and work as a team together.
There you go.
So I'm excited about it.
Yeah. I mean, these are all really promising films, and following off with the recent success of the latest, you know, X-Men trilogy, I'm pretty sure that it's going to be really awesome for a lot of the fans. I'm excited, and I'm hoping they don't bring back Apocalypse. So with that... Well, with that, you know what? We're going to go ahead and wrap this up. And again, we want to thank you for listening in. And of course, if you have any comments, drop us a line on our Facebook page or our Twitter page at twitter.com/philosophy101 or our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers. Again, this was a great conversation. And if you want to add to it, let us know what you want to say.
I know, we kind of sound so smart.
We do.
We're not really that smart sometimes.
No,
but
we're
this
not.
Episode, we sound smart.
We really went for it, didn't we? So, like I said, let us know what you think. And, of course, like we said also, if you want to check out previous episodes, Go ahead and check out vgbstudios.com, where you can check out all our previous episodes as well as other great podcasts. This was a great conversation. So, Chad, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Eddie.
And, yeah, from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
Class dismissed.